Welcome to the New Mission Career Transition Podcast, where we interview service members that transition to civilian careers successfully and DoD and HR professionals that help with that transition. We're here to provide you information that helps you transition with confidence. I'm very excited. This is our first video episode. We have numerous episodes that were audio only. So if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, you can also find us on YouTube at New Mission Career Transition. There's a link in the episode notes. Our first video podcast guest is Pat D'Amico. He is a prior soldier, officer, MP officer, who had deployment experience and then transitioned to the civilian sector and has accumulated a large array of skills in both recruiting, recruiting development, marketing, program development, curriculum development, and now is a business owner of About Face Development LLC. If About Face Development sounds familiar, think Colonel Hackworth. By the way, we've got a great story about Colonel Hackworth in this episode. So, hey, if you're a fan, you're going to enjoy it. If you're interested in any of those roles, you're going to find this information beneficial. So stay tuned. Pat D'Amico, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome.
Hi, Chris, Alexander. Thanks so much for having me today. I'm excited.
I'm excited, too. I mean, it was first of all, we had a great phone conversation before we started this recording. I'm really excited to talk to somebody that has experience in the commercial area of whether it's marketing, recruiting, product development, training curriculum development, all of those things. And then you finally ended up leveraging or harnessing all those skills you developed and created your own company as the founder and owner of About Face LLC. And I'm excited to get to that. But before we do, I'd like you to, well, introduce yourself and give us an idea of who you are. So first, where did you grow up and how did you get into the Army?
Well, Chris, as you and I talked in our pre-call, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, which I often say is a great place to be from. So my wife's from there as well. But I grew up in Buffalo, and essentially for me, I was not an exceptional academic student in high school. I admit that. And so I found myself in my senior year asking myself, what was I going to do? As my parents were asking as well, and I was like, oh, I'm going to go to college. And they thought that was kind of interesting because there was no money to send me, and I certainly wasn't going to, the schools weren't clamoring over trying to get me there. So ironically, I was in the guidance office one day and waiting to meet with my guidance counselor, and on the bookshelves that had all of the brochures for the schools, there was this one tiny little section that had all the military schools. So there was the West Point brochure, the Annapolis brochure, the Citadel, the MI. And literally in that moment, I looked and said, I think I need to go to military school, which, you know, is not something that most students or kids at 17 kind of think of. And in a very odd, turn of events, I got home that day from school, that very day, and sitting on the kitchen table with the mail was a postcard promotional thing for Valley Forge Military College. And I kind of was like, well, that's interesting. But nonetheless, I could not get a West Point appointment. I did apply for a four-year Army scholarship, which I did not get. But, of course, the Army, always having an option, approached me and said, hey, look, there's another option here. You can enlist in the Army, and you can apply for a two-year early commissioning program. So, which is what I did. I enlisted in the Army, graduated, left for basic training about a month later, went to basic training, and lo and behold, over the summer was advised, hey, you've won this two-year scholarship, and I used that scholarship to attend Valley Forge Military College. So that was really the beginning of my journey. So I went there freshman and sophomore year, got a commission at the end of my sophomore year. I served in the National Guard, actually, in Pennsylvania during that time, because obviously I enlisted and had a service obligation. And then after graduating from Valley Forge, I finished my degree at Catholic University and then went on active duty immediately after earning my bachelor's degree.
All right, great. And so what did you do in the Army?
So I was an MP, actually, which was my first choice, and my which was to be in a combat MP unit, which I was fortunate enough to do. So so I initially, while I was at Catholic, I was a platoon leader with the DC National Guard because I had already been commissioned a second lieutenant. And then I was assigned to a TRADOC unit at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, a combat MP deployable unit, and spent the majority of my time during my service primarily overseas. So deployed to Panama. I did some time actually in Central America during one of the summers there, doing some odd stuff based out of Honduras, and then went to Panama after the invasion, and then participated in Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, all those times as a platoon leader.
Oh, wow. Okay. That must have been an interesting deployment.
Yeah, the deployment to Panama, I was almost more interesting. We arrived immediately after the invasion and found ourselves in a situation where we were responsible for law enforcement activity for the entire city of Panama. So we were working with the Panamanian new police force, which was an odd mix of Noriega's former supporters and those that were opposed to Noriega. So it was not an easy time to kind of manage those relationships. And we were trying to identify who was who. And in a difficult time, training the police force and getting them up to speed was a real challenge. So that was an interesting deployment. Desert Shield, Desert Storm was quick, but we were there forever. It felt like a lifetime. We spent about 6 months there. And we did primarily POW missions and area security missions. And then I actually also deployed to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Back when there was no prison at Guantanamo, and what's ironic about it, and I have a group that does that does meetings every couple months, and we had one on Guantanamo Bay. And what was interesting was most of the folks were younger than me. When I got to Guantanamo, we arrived at the airfield, and they drove us out to the old airport, the old military airport, and it was completely empty. And the hangar had about 500 cots in it. And they walked us out in the airfield and they said, in a week, you're going to have thousands and thousands of Haitian migrants here. You need to build a camp. And so we actually built the first isolation section, I would call it, of Guantanamo Bay. So the folks that we had that were a problem, we put them out into this remote area of the base, and that eventually became the Guantanamo prison, which of course years later was, you know, all the controversy around that. So
That's interesting. I've been there.
And to Guantanamo.
It's not
the worst duty in the world, gotta tell you. I mean, I'm a big Caribbean fan, so you know.
it's a great place for TAD. I don't know if I'd want to be there for 6 months.
I was there for about four, maybe a little bit longer, and my entire platoon lived in one of those bomb shelters, and the bomb shelters were infested with tarantulas, which were not poisonous, but I had a lot of soldiers that slept outside because they just could not stomach. I mean, they were huge.
All right,
it's interesting deployment.
No.
Alexander, not for you?
No. Mm-mm.
I got to say one more than banana rats. Like,
yes.
First time I saw one, I thought it was a cat. It was like,
they're absolutely massive. Yeah.
I don't want to talk about it anymore. Moving on.
The iguanas were beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They still steal food. They're big. And it's the Marines on the guard post. You know, they probably were feeding them, and they got tamed and a little aggressive. Okay, so about the time that you transitioned, let's just make sure that I've got the chronology correct. About what year, what time frame was that?
So I left Guantanamo Bay, was my last deployment, and then I was promoted to captain, and I served as the deputy provost marshal for Fort Belvoir, Virginia for around 6 months before I went to my officer advanced course down at Fort McClellan. And immediately after the advanced course, I transitioned out. So that would have been 1993. Yeah.
93. Yeah, because it would have been post Desert Shield, Desert Storm. But okay. All right. Well, I know that the transitioning time, I mean, certainly the amount of services that are offered to transitioning service members now makes when you got out pale in comparison. So, and certainly that's not why we have you on. We're here to kind of absorb a lot of the things that you've learned in the private sector, and then help us figure out where we fit in. So, but I mean, I think I still want to touch on it. I'm sure that transition was still stressful, but did you have a game plan when you planned on getting out?
Sort of, I'd say. I think it's germane to our discussion because it kind of feeds into and informs some of my private sector work later. So it was pretty common in that time frame to work with one of these transition, what they call junior military officer transition organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Most common one at the time was Cameron Brooks. My timing of separation didn't really work for them. So I worked with an organization based out of Florida called Leaders. And so what they did was they essentially brought you, they prepped you, and then they brought you to these conferences where you got to meet with a bunch of different organizations. And for me, I really had narrowed down to interviews between Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer. The pharmaceutical market was growing at a huge rate back then. So a lot of, you know, my peers were moving into sales roles in the pharmaceutical sector. So that's essentially, you know, what I ended up doing. Now, it was funny because a buddy of mine and I were both interviewing at the same time, and he ended up getting Daytona Beach, Florida, and I ended up in Jackson, Tennessee, which I'm sure you don't know where it is, or and I've never been there. But it's a pit stop between Memphis and Nashville, and I can tell you that being a, you know, being an Italian guy growing up in New York, finding himself in Jackson, Tennessee was not the easiest place to live.
Okay. Well, that sounds like an interesting start. I mean, I know that when you were there, and I'm trolling your LinkedIn profile, it's complete yeah. for the most part. But I mean, you had sales representative, manager, sales recruiting, and then director, U.S. sales recruiting, candidate sourcing, and internal search. So a lot of emphasis on the recruiting aspect. What was that like at Johnson & Johnson, and how well did you kind of move into that role?
Well, what happened was I had spent about 2 years, 2.5 years in Jackson, Tennessee as a sales rep, and I was looking to get promoted. I had been through the management development program and was eligible to be promoted. And my thought was, hey, I'd really like to get out of this area and get back up to the Northeast, you know, where more of my family and friends were. And my boss's boss at the time said, no, that's not going to happen. You're going to end up in Atlanta, Nashville, Memphis, or Birmingham. And I was like, well, I'd really like to get out of this area. He said, that's not going to happen. So what occurred was, and to be frank, the pharmaceutical sales job was not by any means my favorite job, and I was looking to do something else. So someone else at J&J heard about me, got in touch with me, and said, hey, look, I'm looking to, we've received money to run a 6-month pilot at J&J headquarters to look at centralizing sales recruiting for Johnson & Johnson. All the other functions had already been centralized from a recruiting standpoint, but they're giving us money to do this. And this gentleman said, I'm willing to move you up here. We'll do this for 6 months. If it works, great. And then it continues. If it doesn't, at least you'll be up here and we'll find you a management job up here. So it was a perfect opportunity. It was sort of a godsend at the time. Hmm. So I moved up to New Jersey and worked at the J&J headquarters. And after 6 months, the department was approved. So it became a permanent department in J&J recruiting. So over the years that I was there, I not only hired the other recruiters around the country, eventually I took over the department. And so I ran the recruiting for J&J for sales for both, for all consumer pharma and for medical device for the continental United States. Uh-huh. Great experience, great opportunity to build a new department within J&J. It was the first department I'd had an opportunity to build at J&J, which is sort of a hallmark of my career. I've been really fortunate. I've built a lot of departments that didn't exist. And it was during that time that I really looked at, can we expand the recruiting of, you know, military recruiting into Johnson & Johnson, because I was passionate about it. It had come from the military. And so I actually did a lot of work to expand and bring more veterans and more people transitioning out into Johnson & Johnson, some of whom I still stay in touch with, some of whom have had tremendous careers. And so it was a great experience from that standpoint. And then to your point, I also took over candidate sourcing. At one point they approached me and said, hey, look, our recruiters are doing both finding candidates and working those jobs with the hiring managers. We want to separate that out. So they approached me and said, would you be willing to start the sourcing department, which will source for all functions for J&J across the U.S.? And so started that department new as well while I was still running sales recruiting.
That's interesting. So, I mean, essentially you were recruiting from two different sources. One, you know, the private sector and those that aren't in the military. And then you're setting up another program that pulls in military talent. What, even though I don't suspect it would be too different from what individuals would see today, what were the pros and cons of those that you would pull in from the military side into those roles at J&J compared to those that didn't have military experience?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was the topic of many conversations, right? So, you know, J&J is not a starting point and wasn't at that time a starting point for most people in sales, right? I mean, to get to J&J, you normally had to have sales experience and show that you had success, and then you would be considered. So now I'm here promoting, can we, you know, bringing in folks that have no sales experience, but frankly have the discipline was one of the real keys, right? You do not have to worry about these folks getting up and going out and working hard every day. The other thing about the folks in the military was their innate leadership ability made them easily promotable fairly quickly. So, you know, in any organization in sales, you've got a set of people who want to be promoted, and you've got a set of people who really just want to do the sales rep job for their entire career. The majority, if not all, the folks coming in from the military really provided a great bench for promotion. And the great thing was because they had leadership experience, once they were promoted, they were far less of a concern in getting them trained up as a new manager, what we would normally refer to as a new manager, somebody who's been a sales rep. Now all of a sudden they wake up one day, they're a manager. You know, there's a lot they don't know. With folks in the military, there was more they didn't know taking the sales job, but to be honest, they would work really hard, so they would make it happen. But then once they were promoted, you know, the senior leadership didn't really have to worry too much about did they know how to lead, did they know how to manage. So those are sort of the differences in those backgrounds.
Okay, that's interesting, and not entirely surprising. I mean, I think we've heard that being said, that one of the benefits of military service members that are transitioning out into the private sector is they have a leadership skill set that isn't very common or may not be as common in the private sector, which predominantly focuses on management, and those two things are different.
Yeah, and you know, we may get into this, or I can mention it now because I've seen it over my career. I think people would be very surprised at the lack of leadership and management development that organizations provide. And when I say organizations, I mean I could give you five or six names of companies that you'd be like, oh yeah, I know that brand, I know that brand. And they just don't provide it. I think I was a little spoiled being at J&J. J&J does one of the best, if not the best job, certainly in the industry I spend most of my time, which is life sciences. They do a tremendous job. But once I left J&J and I started getting exposure to other organizations, and then obviously in my consulting work where I'm working with these organizations, it's incredible to me how little of that's provided. So when you have somebody who comes in with those skills, there's a distinct advantage to that, right? I mean, they're where somebody coming out of the military and taking, let's say, a role in an organization for 2 or 3 years, then getting promoted to a manager, you know, they're as prepared to manage as somebody who didn't come from the military and has taken 10 years as a leader to kind of figure those things out. Because to be frank, there's a lot more concentrated leadership development when you're in the military than there is even if an organization has leadership and management development. You know, what you would get in a year or two in the military will take 10 years in the private sector. So I see that so much now.
Wow, that's good. That's reassuring.
That's good. I'm working
There's
on
a
it.
Chance. There's a chance. No, that's great. So I want to transition a little bit. I know that you were in the sales and the recruiting side for J&J, and then you had a little bit of a transition into the marketing. I know on your LinkedIn profile it says Cordis Endovascular Johnson & Johnson. I don't know if that was a different division, but what happened from the recruiting realm when you made the transition into marketing, and what was that like?
Well, the great thing about the role in recruiting is that I got exposure and worked with every division at Johnson & Johnson. So, I mean, the reality is I put myself in a position to have a pick of where I wanted to go. And I wanted to move out of the pharmaceutical area and move into the medical device area, which is what I've now been doing since that time. So I looked at the organizations I was working with, narrowed down to a couple, and then settled on. I really wanted to go work for Cordis. It was an exciting, growing business at the time. So I had a relationship with the VP of sales because I was doing work. You know, my team was supporting their recruiting, and they were hiring, frankly, one of our biggest hires of junior military officers. So when an opportunity came open, I made the transition to sales operations, which really was a natural sort of transition based on my military background, right? You kind of understand the operational aspect of an organization. So, you know, he reached out to me and said, hey, look, we need to create a sales operations department. We don't have one. And so would you be willing to come over and build that? So I went over to Cordis and built that organization up and did that for a few years. And then at that point, transitioned into a sales leader for that business in New York City. So my first year I had New York and New Jersey all the way up to Maine. Fortunately, in year two, the business grew and my area shrunk, but primarily I had the Metro New York City and Northern New Jersey areas as sales manager for about 5 years. Great team, a lot of success, great experience. So that's what I did during that time. And then after that job, transitioned into a marketing job.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a lot there. I mean, and it's not just, I mean, you've got like division sales manager experience and product director, but I mean, it sounds almost like your experience set was also creating new structures within an organization to accomplish like a new type of task, almost business development in some sense, but internal to the organization. And I'm dangerously throwing out titles that I only have a certain level of understanding on what they mean. So by the way, if I say something that doesn't make sense, please like call me out on it. Cause
yeah, you're tracking. We're good.
Okay. All right, good. So you went from J&J to Invitech and you became the vice president of commercial operations. And that seemed like a pretty big promotion. Was it, or was it a complete?
It was. I had transitioned out of marketing at J&J into a training role for about a year. And then I was approached by some former folks that I had worked with at Cordis, specifically the president of Cordis came to me and said, hey, look, this organization that's based in Europe wants to launch in the U.S. We have to put together an entire organization. Would you be willing to come over as a VP of commercial operations? So it was a great opportunity. And it was a big job. Anytime you work in a startup environment in an organization, you wear a lot of hats. So I had a responsibility for a number of things. My primary focuses were ensuring training of the sales force. I had responsibility for corporate accounts solely. So I was responsible for all of the national accounts negotiations as well as the government accounts negotiations. And it was just a real opportunity, again, to build something that didn't exist, right? It was the first one in the role. But the experience you get in a startup is really hard to match in the private sector. Even though I've had a lot of experience building new departments within large organizations, you get exposure to so many things. And so that was a real advantage to me. And that president that I had, who had been my boss back at Cordis, had done me one of the best favors. I hate to back up, but I think it's really important.
Yeah.
When I took the job at Cordis, he said, look, here are your responsibilities. We're clear on those. If there is anything you want to be involved in, just let me know. And it was one of the best things anyone ever did for me because I overly took advantage of that. So I looked at the things I didn't really understand. I was like, I don't have any real finance experience. So there's this finance project going on. I'd like to be on that. I don't really have a ton of, at the time, marketing experience. I'd like to be on that. So I really use that. And I think it really helped me when I moved into the VP commercial operations job at the startup because I considered myself a jack of all trades and a master of a few is the way I used to refer to myself. I could speak intelligently in an executive meeting about almost any function or topic, as well as anybody who that wasn't their primary function. So that really helped me going to Invitech. We were on a 5-year plan at Invitech. We had a very novel new therapy and device that we were looking to get FDA approval and launch. And the owners, who were one in Italy, one in Germany, discovered that it was going to take not only a lot of money, but a significant amount of time to get it approved through the FDA. So they decided to sell the company early. So after a couple of years, they sort of put us up for sale. And that's how I ended up with Medtronic. So I'd gone from the largest healthcare company in the world, which was J&J. Now I was with Medtronic, which is the largest medical device company in the world. So not too dissimilar in sort of you know, that scenario. Although the one thing I will say about Medtronic is they weren't doing any leadership and management development. That was the thing that was the biggest shock to me. I'm like, this is because when I took over training there, I asked my staff one day, I said, so can somebody brief me on the leadership and management development program? And the answer was no. And I said, no, because nobody can explain it. And they said, no, we don't have one. So It took me a few years to get something in place there.
Okay. Man. So I think my mind's whirling. So there's a dichotomy between the vibe, I'll use vibe loosely, the vibe at a very large corporation and that being of a startup. And kind of one of the things that I've noticed in the military, and it's a small critique, but oftentimes, particularly in larger organizations, we have bureaucratic stovepipes that we're constantly trying to get around. It sounds like you had, when you were at Cordis, like you had an amazing leader that allowed you to break through those bureaucratic stovepipes, but that's probably not the norm. And then you've got like this really small startup, relatively speaking, where everybody's hungry. They're probably, the work hours are long, but the vibe is energized because everybody wants the team and the company to win. Are there benefits and drawbacks when somebody's like trying to consider, well, what kind of company do I see myself fitting into? Do I fit into a large corporate realm, or do I fit into the small startup? I mean, how do I approach that thing or that question? Any ideas?
Yeah, that's a really, there's a lot there, Chris. What's interesting is, you know, some large organizations, there are places within those organizations where it feels like a startup. So an organization like J&J, which at the time I was there operated very siloed, very autonomously. So the small organizations within J&J could have sort of a startup feel, right? They were really they tried to keep the corporate structure at a distance. So some of those organizations had that feel, especially for those, some of which were outside of the New Jersey corridor, which is where most of J&J was located. So there are a couple companies out in California that had a very much a startup vibe. But in general, most large corporations that you would know the brands of, you do have that challenge, right? So there's the good and the bad. So the advantage of large corporations is you have a ton of resources at your fingertips. No matter what role or function you're in, there's always a structure for things, there's a process for things, there's resources available, those sorts of things. The challenge with those organizations is they're very bureaucratic. So getting to those resources sometimes can be very challenging. Affecting a change in a process can be very difficult. On the startup side, it's the complete opposite, right? You're nimble, things can get done quickly, but to an extent, you kind of have to figure things out on your own. You know, you don't have this big behemoth with all these resources. You're kind of, you know, pulling and nickeling, you know, looking for the nickels and dimes laying around that you can actually put into practice. So there are some folks that absolutely thrive. For folks that are extremely, extremely risk averse, a large corporation is probably, you know, best suited for them, right? Because a startup is by nature a risk. There's potentially big payoff, right? If you go in at a very early stage and you're given equity in the organization and that organization thrives and ends up being bought, which is usually the goal, then you may have a big payday and a big payout. But, you know, in our circumstance, you know, to give you an example, we had a 5-year plan to sell the organization. So a bunch of us left large companies and left behind equity that, you know, we had no choice but to leave behind, go to the startup. It's a 5-year plan. Well, we were sold after 2. So most of that equity was not realized. So then you're in a situation of you're trying to make that up. So again, being risk averse would put you sort of more likely to be comfortable in a large organization. But if, you know, you're more of a risk taker, if you want greater autonomy, if you want the ability to sort of be creative and think of things and change organizations and a fast moving environment, then a startup, you know, may be a good place for someone like that. My experience in the medical device sector is everybody works hard. I mean, that's just the reality of the space. Now, that runs the gamut, right? There are certain people who the job is closer to a 9-to-5, but there's also the reality of a lot of the organizations I work with, based on the therapies that the solutions they sell, they're on call 24 hours a day, every day of the year. So, you know, I worked some organizations that have worked in organizations where it's like, I want to get together with my buddies and have a beer. I get to have somebody cover my call. That's just the way it goes. So, so that can be an element of that as well.
You bring up equity. Maybe we'll come back around to that because I do have some questions regarding that, particularly when you're looking at the benefits package of a different type of offer that somebody's made for the position you're applying to. And then I'm sure there's like, even though there's some, you have to have a slightly higher risk tolerance for a startup because you don't know whether or not the startup is going to be successful. There are probably some financial measures somebody could take in order to hedge their bet. Like in other words, increase the size of your emergency fund so that, you know, if you find yourself out of work because the company sells quicker and mm-hmm. there isn't enough equity, you still have enough time to be able to get that new position at a new company. But I don't know. I kind of like it's nice to hear that you can still find segments in a very large company like Johnson & Johnson that has that energy that you could get from a startup as well. So that's reassuring.
You do. And I think it's because people don't realize these large corporations are not, you know, many of them are not one company. They're not one entity from a solutions or a product standpoint, right? I mean, I don't remember. That's at the time I left J&J, I think we had 160 different operating businesses, right? Okay. So that's a lot. When I was at Medtronic, just the group I was responsible for, I think when I took the job, we had like six. And I think when I left, we had 13 because we had bought some other organizations. But, you know, I always thought it was funny because at Medtronic, when I got there, people would say, oh my gosh, we're so siloed. And I'm like, no, work at J&J, that's siloed, this isn't siloed. So yeah. Grass is always greener, right? We always look at what's in front of us, not realizing what it's like on the other side.
Yeah. Okay, no, thank you. So I want to transition again to kind of what you're doing now, because right about the time that you completed your time at Medtronic, in approximately 2017, you started your own business called About Face Development. So tell me, what's the origin story of About Face Development?
Well, first I'll let you know what happened. So at Medtronic, I had been in the job for about 5 years or so. I was ready to move on, but I was living where I still live now. When we with Invitech, the startup, we put it in Bethlehem, Allentown, what we call the Pennsylvania, we call the Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania area. So we put the startup here. So when Medtronic bought us, I originally was based in California, so no one asked me to move. And then I was shifted to being based in Minneapolis. No one asked me to move. And I had no reason to be in the home office because I was running largely a virtual organization, but I was traveling to where we were conducting trainings. So there was no reason to be in the home office, and nobody pressured me to be there. But at around the five-year mark, they approached me and said, so your next role is going to be here in Minneapolis, and you have to move. And nothing against Minneapolis. It was not a place it wasn't a time or a place I was really that interested in. So I had to make a decision. Do I want to do the same? Do I want to milk this job? Which I was not comfortable with that. I was ready to do something else. But at that point, I was viewed as, you know, my profession was I'm a learning and development executive. It's a pretty small group of people in the life sciences space. There's probably 20 to 30 of us. And I had gotten my master's in education to support that. So this was really my professional area. And so I started looking at other organizations that were more local here, which is not bad because I'm right over the border of New Jersey and there's lots of companies here. But two things had really happened for me that were impactful. I had turned 50 years old at that point. So that was, you know, for me was sort of a big thing. And my father had passed away, which was probably the most impactful thing that's happened to me. Hard to say, I mean, other than my marriage, maybe, and my children being born, the most impactful thing. And I just needed to do something different. So I made a decision to go out on my own as a consultant. And that's not an easy thing to do because in the space I'm in, of learning and development, probably four out of every five people that leave and go into consulting that have been in corporate setting a long time, they end up going back. It's not easy to really succeed because there's just a lot of challenges. But I had a really distinct plan. I had contracts before I actually resigned. I had contracts in place that would help me start my business. I could not afford to leave Medtronic and resign and then start this business and start looking for for customers and for clients. There was just financially, that was not an option. So I actually worked to do that prior to departing. And so that's how I ended up going out on my own. But I think your question then comes to the origin of About Face. So I read this incredible book back in the late 80s, and I did pull it out because I knew we were talking about it. So I read this amazing book. This is still my first copy, called About Face. And it was,
what do you know?
Look at that. Love it. So About Face was written by this gentleman by the name of David Hackworth. So I read this book immediately after it was published. And it was, to me, like as many would say, it was, as a leader in the military, it was literally my Bible. In fact, the newest foreword of the newest edition is written by Jocko Willink. And he says in the foreword, you know, me and my peers, this was our Bible. So it had moved me so much. And I considered him, I considered Hack to be this mentor that I didn't know. So I wrote him a letter. And lo and behold, he wrote back, which was an incredible moment. And, you know, I it's interesting. I have a couple of them in here. So Hack used to like to communicate with postcards, and which I always found interesting because anybody reading them, you know, everybody passing them along could see what was on them. But he wrote back, and it started what, you know, became a very long-term friendship between Hack and I. He was a mentor to me, incredible gentleman. When he passed, it was a massive loss for me. But in both respect and admiration to him, as well as the fact that it fit, right? I decided to name my organization About Face Development, with the idea being, you know, About Face is a change of direction. And most of what I do, you know, when it comes to my clients, is I'm trying to affect a change, some sort of change in direction or some sort of change in behavior. So I really thought it fit. And so so it's, you know, Hack was a big part of my life. I think next to my father dying and another mentor in the Army, his passing was one of the most impactful to me.
Mm. Yeah, I am. It's great to actually meet somebody that had a that knew him personally.
Yeah,
and I know when we talked over the phone, you also said that Colonel Hackworth found a way to get your ass chewed at a NCO academy.
What's
the story about that? Spill the beans.
I was in my officer advanced course. I'm gonna start this story by saying you should have known better.
Oh,
because I knew Hack well enough to know better, but. I was in my officer advanced course, and there was probably 30 to 40 of us in my class, in my group, and we attended one day a combat stress class. And I can't tell you if it was at least an hour, it might have been as many as 3 hours, but the instructor, I have to mention, had no combat experience. Now, there were three or four of us in the room who did. And so the first thing that was curious was, you know, we're in a combat stress class with an instructor who has no combat experience. And at some point, I can't tell you what it was, at some point during the class, somebody mentioned Hackworth. It was not me. I remember. Somebody mentioned Hackworth, and the instructor, who is a major, you know, spoke immediately very, like launched into this very disparaging set of comments about Hack. And a lot of the class sort of would reel back, and most of us had read the book, and people were very supportive. So I wrote Hack a quick letter, and I said, hey, you know, something happened today. I'm, you know, at the MP school, I'm in my advanced course, and, you know, we're in this combat stress class, and, you know, your name came up, and the instructor, you know, didn't speak very, you know, kindly of you, but, you know, I wanted to let you know that, you know, the whole class supported you, whatever. So that was it. So I want to say within 2 weeks, I'm in the class, and we had two captains that were sort of in charge of our class that were instructors there. And one of them came to me and said, the commandant wants to see you. Now the commandant's like going to the president of the university, right? The commandant wants to see you. I've never even seen the commandant, right? And this is my second tour here, right? So I had no idea why. And my instructor said, I don't know why, but he called and said, send this captain to my office. So I walk in the office, and he's sitting at his desk, and I report, and he says, I just got off the phone with Colonel Hackworth. And he was screaming at me, did you write a letter to David Hackworth, how do you know Colonel Hackworth? And so it was a very uncomfortable scenario. The irony was I explained myself and as best I could, and the commandant was furious that I had shared this and written to him, and he's like, you know, if you know Hackworth, you know that he flies off the handle, which I did, right? Hack had a temper. You know that he flies off the handle. But I left his office without any resolution or understanding of what the outcome was going to be. So I left the office. I went back to the classroom. It was the end of the day. Everyone else had gone home. And my two instructors were waiting there for me. And they were like, what was that about? And I said, well, you know, I told them the story. And they were like, so what's happening? Like, are you being punished? You being IRCA 15? I said, I actually don't know. He didn't say. He just told me I was dismissed. So it was never mentioned again. Until, of course, I spoke to Hack. I tried to reach him immediately, and he was somewhere out of the country. But I spoke to him within a couple weeks, and I was like, really? Like, really? Like, did it ever occur to you that that was going to come down on me? And, you know, and in that moment, he was still pissed. He was like, that's not your fault. You were just sharing with me, blah, blah, you know. We laughed only slightly about it maybe 10 years later. He never found it an amusing story, even years later, because, I mean, I guess from his perspective, somebody wasn't being kind about him. But, yeah, so that was my story about my meeting with the commandant at the MP school, having written a letter to Hack.
So Colonel Hackworth was like, this is your character development opportunity. and the commandant was like probably a huge Colonel Hackworth fan, and the only time he's ever talked to him was on a one-way conversation of an ass chewing.
Right? Could you imagine?
He was crushed.
This captain who's in your class knows this, you know, knows Hack, and you get this call from Hackworth, and it's your chance to speak to, you know, to this legend, and he's screaming at you. So yeah, he wasn't happy. He wasn't
goodness.
Bad judgment, or so he told me. But you said, I think that's, yeah, that was the his main message was really, really poor judgment.
Wow. So. Well, you know, hopefully 10 years later for the commandant, he was like, I've been able to talk to Colonel Hackworth, but he just leaves out the whole point. He was getting his ass chewed. That's funny.
Oh, yeah, I'm assuming Hack never called him again.
Yeah. Probably not. So, now that I've like completely derailed the conversation, I gotta get it back on track here, and this is all my fault. But tell me a little bit about what About Face development does. Like, what does your company do, and then what are some of the things that you learned starting your own business that maybe some transitioning service members can take away if they want to go the entrepreneur route?
Well, that's there's a lot there. So, What have I learned? Let me start there before getting to what I do. When you run your own business, all the resources, like, I thought, I worked in a corporate environment where there were tons of resources. Even when I was starting new departments, then I worked in a startup environment, there were less resources. Then you go out on your own and there are no resources, right? There is no one there to help you. You are literally responsible for everything. So I think that the biggest thing that I really had to learn to focus on was really the financial management of the business, right? Somebody had given me this great advice and said, hey, use QuickBooks, right? Just as a tool. And that's, frankly, for me, that's been fantastic, right? It helps me manage a lot of that. But, you know, you're invoicing, you're chasing customers for payment. You are, you're filing paperwork, you know, your taxes. Mm-hmm. It's really a lot of work from a financial perspective. So I had to really learn how to compartmentalize that, right? There are, I'm not capable of saying one day a month or 2 days a month I'm going to do this, but there are those points where I'm like, okay, I'm getting behind here. I've got to block out a day next week to catch up. I've got to reconcile all my accounts. I've got to chase my invoices. I've got to do invoicing. Although one thing that I don't set time aside for is invoicing, right? When I do a gig, I try to invoice right away. I mean, that's an easy one, because you never know how long it's going to take you to get paid. You'd be shocked at how long some of the companies take to pay, even big companies. But again, because of their process, not because they don't have the money. So there's that aspect of it. And then the other thing that I've learned is every year I really focus on making an investment. I make a decision on an investment in my business. Some of them have been worthwhile. Some of them have been not. So one example would be, I was doing quite a bit of one-on-one coaching, but I was not technically executive coach certified. And that, you know, matters to a lot of organizations. So I made a decision to invest and get my executive coaching certification through Berkeley, which was a great program. And so that really was an investment that was worthwhile. On the flip side, you'll both laugh when you hear this. I decided to, when I first started my business, I called myself a veteran-owned business, but I wasn't registered as a veteran-owned business because there is a process for that. So I made a decision, hey, I'm going to register as a veteran-owned business. I partnered with an organization that both handles that, and I wanted an opportunity to bid on government contracts, right? I mean, somebody once said to me that there's one well that never dries up, and that's the government, and that's the truth, right? When nobody else has money to spend, the government's still going to be spending money. And so I thought, well, that's a great opportunity, and it is. But I got to tell you the truth, I actually ended up not pursuing it because the process for government contracts is so intensive and overwhelming. I mean, when I tell you one government contract, even the smallest one, is 10 times as much work as I've had to do a major contract with a major brand name organization in the private sector. It's so cumbersome. So that's one of the things that I do. To me, that's since I don't have a tangible product I'm producing and selling, that more or less is my investment back in the business, right? So I look at something and say, okay, this opportunity really looks good. You know, one year I did a full marketing push where I worked with a couple organizations, I wrote a handful of articles, they promoted them, that sort of thing. So that's the other thing I think that's been one of the biggest takeaways, which I probably haven't thought about till you just asked that. So thank you for that. Sometimes I'm asked that question and I didn't really think about that one. So that's sort of a couple areas I've really learned. My focus is I spend about probably 30 to 40% of my time facilitating programs for selling skills. Most of that area for me is what I would call with advanced sellers, so really experienced salespeople, so senior corporate account executives, things like that. So those programs would be things like advanced negotiations courses or executive level selling programs where I do them live in person, and depending on what the client's looking for, I try to get them on a reinforcement program. So that's one big piece of my business. The other big piece of my business, which I'm incredibly passionate about, is the leadership and management development. So I not only facilitate a lot of those programs, but what I love doing is, trying to understand what does the organization think their gaps are. My experience, they're usually about half right, literally, right? So, but I dig in and I'll do what we call a diagnostic. I'll do a bunch of interviews and I kind of dig into, what skills do you have? What skills are you missing? And then I'll devise a program that works for them over time. Because one of the things that I tell my clients is, leadership development is a never-ending journey, right? There is no finish line with leadership and management development. To this day, I consider myself more of a student of leadership now than at any probably point prior to this, right? That's just because this is what I do, and you always need to be developing that. So I'm very careful with clients to say this is a long-term commitment and a long-term investment in your leadership and management. And why it's so important today, if I may just share a really interesting piece of information. So just curious from the two of you, what do you think the number one reason people leave a job is?
Lack of fulfillment.
I like that. It's not
salary.
Yeah, everybody thinks it's money. Money's almost never the reason. Unless you're completely out of whack, money's not the factor. So during the Industrial Revolution, the number one reason people left jobs was their personal safety, right? I had relatives. My grandfather worked at Bethlehem Steel. He used to tell stories about people dying at the plant. But post the Industrial Revolution, when safety was no longer, after OSHA, and safety was no longer an issue, the number one reason people leave jobs is their immediate manager. They don't like their boss, a poor manager. And that's been the number one reason for the last 60 to 70 years. And so that's important, because if the number one reason people leave jobs is because they have a poor immediate, they have a manager who lacks competence in being a leader or manager, that in itself is the reason why organizations should invest in learning and development. Now, what's also interesting though is The number two answer as to why people left jobs was never even close enough to even be bothered talking about. It was, hey, the number one reason people leave jobs is they're a media manager, and that's what it is. And then about like probably 6 or 7 years ago now, LinkedIn did this large-scale survey, and we started seeing this creep up of the number two reason. And the number two reason people are leaving jobs today is because of a lack of development. So 20 years ago, if I'd have been interviewing a candidate to come to J&J, and you get to the interview and you say, hey, what questions do you have? If a candidate had asked me, what kind of development are you going to provide me? I'd have probably kicked him out of the room. I'd have been like, are you kidding me? You should just be happy to be sitting here. You know, you're interviewing with J&J. Today, you have to have, today you're going to get that question, and, and you really need to have a good answer for it, because employees' development and their personal interest in being developed is now very high. So that helps me in my area of business, because that's essentially what I do. I'm looking to provide development. But the amount of clients that I go to or that come to me, I'm doing a what we call a diagnostic now, and I'm interviewing a bunch of leaders at the organization, and I typically will ask the question, have you ever had formal leadership and management development? And I'm dealing with an organization now that the answer is perpetually none. And some of these people have been people managers for 15, 20 years. So it is significantly lacking. And if you're not training people how to be, if you're not trying to make them competent, actively trying to create competence with them as leaders and managers, you are destined to lose people you don't want to lose. So, so that's sort of the two big areas of my business. And then I do some one-on-one executive coaching. I try to limit that. Those one-on-one coaching assignments are, they're pretty demanding, right? I mean, you get into a lot of discussions with that, but I tend to, they tend to be C-suite level executives. And those assignments are usually 6 months at a time. So I'll have a call every 2 weeks, a Zoom every other week, with the C-suite executive for a 6 month time frame. And sometimes we talk about business, and sometimes we talk about things that are totally personal but are impacting their ability to be effective.
Okay. I'm thinking about the leadership development that you provide. There's so many very easy sales points or value propositions you can make on that. It's not only enhancing the performance of the team, but it's also retaining the talent because they feel like they're getting developed. And then it's creating a ready bench for promotion to more senior levels internal to the company, which makes, you not only get somebody with the skills, but you get somebody with the inherent knowledge of how that company and organization functions. And thanks for this. And it's also interesting to hear how the mechanics of the executive coaching, that's interesting. So,
Chris, I got to tell you, if every one of the executives I spoke to was that clear on the return on investment of leadership and management development, my job would be easy. My job selling would be easy.
Yes.
It's tougher to get them there.
Okay, well, that's good. Thank you. Well, I know we're running a little bit tight on time. Sis, do you have any questions?
Oh, I had a bunch, but what I will ask though, going back to your recruiting time, you know, I used to work in recruiting, and then I moved into people operations, and now I'm in the learning and development section and doing all of the onboarding and creating manager training with someone. And so I feel like you're talking my language. But when we go back to recruiting, you know, I always thought, you know, the mark of a good recruiter is for that recruiter to fill the position. But then the mark of a great recruiter is to look beyond the resume to fill the position, because there's so many great skill sets that might not be in black and white, but it's designed to have a conversation with someone in order to fill the position. So what kind of steps would you suggest a company taking in order to look beyond the resume to possibly fill positions for veterans based on the skill sets that you know that they come in with? Because you mentioned leadership skills, managing skills, maybe not the skill for the specific role, but knowing that they can advance pretty quickly. Is there any type of suggestion you would give to companies to look beyond the resume to offer it to veterans?
Well, that's a great question, Alexander. It's timely. So last week, one of my clients, I delivered interviewing and hiring as a two-day program, which is pretty common. And my focus of that program is you need to evaluate candidates based on What are the required attributes for the role? What are the required competencies of the role? And are they a fit for the organizational culture? And if you're not evaluating those candidates equally across the board, because I will sit through interviews and with managers, and a candidate will walk out, and the manager will look at me and go, oh my gosh, that's my person. Love that person. I'm like, oh, I can tell you loved him. You actually didn't ask him a single thing that was of value. You know nothing about that person or their ability to perform in the job, but you love them. I said, but this morning you interviewed two people and you asked them really in-depth questions that revealed who they are. So having a sound interview process that's behavioral based and aligned to the role that you're interviewing for will allow you to bring forward candidates that will be successful in that role. I always tell folks, the resume is a snapshot. If you are looking for specific requirements of education or experience, right? If that's where you're at, then that's what you'll get from that. But move away from the resume. At the end of the day, you need to find out who is that candidate really? What drives them? And do the tasks that need to be performed in the role, do they have a relatable experience that demonstrates to you that they've been successful in those related, you know, situations, and that they translate? I mean, that's really huge to me. And again, I was interviewing and hiring last week. We had a long discussion about people's resumes. And one of the things that I say is, you know, what's the biggest thing I focus on a resume when I meet with a candidate? I want to know why they moved from job. All I'm really interested in is, why'd you leave this job? Why'd you leave this job? Why'd you leave? I want to establish, you know, what is the pattern there? Because if I hear five times, well, I left this job because I wasn't getting promoted. Well, I left this job because, you know, I wasn't getting promoted. You know, then my natural question is, if you were to come here, what's your expectation of promotion? Because chances are their answer is not going to meet anything in the realm of possibility here. So they're probably not a good candidate. But I think for folks in the military or transitioning, you know, prepping and understanding that your ability to translate the successful things you did into the private sector is absolutely key. That's the one thing that I see the most challenge with, is they're asked a question, and the question, and this is the fault of, frankly, the interviewer. If I'm interviewing somebody coming out of the military or transitioning, and I'm asking a question that's about, you know, can you tell me an example of something that clearly they don't have? Shame on the candidate. Shame on the interviewer. But at the same time, the candidate can be prepared in a way that says, I don't have something that's directly an answer to that, but I have a related example. Let me share that and see if it aligns. And so that's, I'm a stickler for, you know, candidates need to be interviewed with the same standards, because at the end of the day, I see too much of, oh, I love that person. Yeah. And you ask them nothing. Right. And so I've made that mistake. I hired somebody once. This was after I ran recruiting, which is embarrassing for me to admit. Right. I ran recruiting at J&J, my first sales hire. Everybody's thinking, well, this guy's going to hire, you know, a superstar. And I literally hired somebody that I kind of fell in love with, and he was a total disaster. So, you know, so we can get, you know, that sometimes our emotions get the best of us, and we think our gut is all that we need to trust. The gut has a piece of it, but a really small piece. So, so that's sort of, you know, what I think of when I think of people transitioning and how they look at the interviewing process, your ability to translate your successes to the questions that are being asked of you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow. That kind of leads to the segue on, that's a good segue on one of the questions I always ask every guest that comes on the podcast, because we're going to wrap it up here. But Pat, if there were two or three things that you want service members to remember as they prepare for their own transition, what are they?
The first thing is, be confident that your experience is of tremendous value to organizations in the private sector. Do not feel like your experience is not relatable. Do not feel that you're not bringing something. You should feel like you're bringing something to the table that, frankly, your civilian counterparts don't have. Yes, they're going to have things on their side, but the leadership, the discipline, the operating in a chaotic environment, right? Those are things that they bring to the table that other people don't. So that's probably the biggest one. Another one would be you can't over prepare for the interviewing process, right? You, like it or not, are responsible for translating your successes to that hiring manager who most likely will not have a military background. So it's not only preparing, it's speaking to other people. You know, reach out to folks, ask for, you know, contacts in the organization, talk to folks and you know, go back and forth with them about, you know, does this translate? You know, I know I had this success. What do you think that sounds like in the private sector? And ask people for help with that. I mean, you know, one of the great things I feel like we're living in a time, right? I mean, when I joined the Army, there were a lot of Vietnam vets left around, and I'm not going to lie, there was a lot of them were disheartened. They were retiring at the time I got in, and they had a very different experience. The reality is, for the most part, my experience in my lifetime with the respect for veterans is pretty high. And people are you usually find people that are willing to help you out. So don't not ask for that help.
Okay, great. We've asked a lot of questions. I know that there are probably other questions that we missed. And so if there are other questions that transitioning service members want to ask you, how can they get in touch? How can they follow your content and learn more about what you do?
Yeah, so LinkedIn is, you know, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn and all my information is there. So I can easily be found there, Pat D'Amico on LinkedIn. I don't have a common name, so that's kind of nice. I'm fairly easy to find. Or, you know, via my website, which is aboutfacedevelopment.com, or my email is pat@aboutfacedev.com. But I'm sure, Chris, you'll probably be putting that out there with this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll get it into the episode notes. And we're going to share probably a blurb of this on LinkedIn so that people know where to find you as well. But Pat, thank you so much for your time. I got other questions. I'll probably ask you a couple other questions, but we need to keep this at least close to an hour so that people can work out and do whatever they do and listen at the same time. But thank you very much for your time coming on. It was very informative, and I'll be in touch.
Well, thank you both, Alexander, Chris. It's been really an honor to be with you today, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, great. And Pat has left the virtual studio. That was pretty good.
Yeah, this was pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I got to worry about this because this is our first
video.
I know.
I got to paint my face and everything, but, you know.
Hold on. Oh, no. I think you froze. Did you freeze?
You froze.
I froze. Oh, blame it on me. I have to get used to this because, like, we're recording this, and I have to go back and listen to see whether or not we actually did freeze. So anyway,
it's fine
because we probably didn't. But I thought this was great. It was mm-hmm. awesome talking to Pat. Not every day that you get to meet somebody who actually had Colonel Hackworth as a mentor. That was just personally like entertaining listening to that story. And then it also listening to his broad array of experiences post-military. I mean, certainly getting out of the military and going into working for Johnson & Johnson was a transition, but then there was another transition of what he did to prepare from working for a company to starting his own company. And the fact that he lined up contracts even before he submitted his letter of resignation. Very smart and a good learning point for transition preparation. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I was one of my questions that I wanted to ask him, which I'll probably ask later on, is, you know, how long did it take for him to gain clients while working a full-time job so that he was in that security mode of knowing that he can't move on to his own company? So that would be interesting, a good question for people to ask him and reach out on LinkedIn. There was another question that you asked him, and I can't remember what it is right now, but it was more of how do you know what type of organization you want to join, if it's a startup, if it's, mm-hmm. you know, a big corporation. And one of the things that I wanted to mention was, you know, there's sometimes there are some organizations that come out with an EVP, which is an employee value proposition. And it might not be on websites, but it might be something that is introduced to you during an interview process. And those EVPs really show what the company's about, how they'll help you grow within the company, what they offer. So I only know that because, you know, we're currently working on one as well. And I've been looking out to see what other EVPs are available online at companies. Mm-hmm. And it's a really great tool to find if they do have one so that you know exactly what they offer, so you know what opportunities are available to you.
Wow. Is that an industry-wide, or is that a well-known acronym, EVP or employee value proposition? Is that common?
It's pretty common, but there aren't a lot of companies that have one in mm-hmm. writing.
Okay.
They'll have it as like a benefits sheet, you know, this is what we offer, but it's more of like a statement. This is what we value as you as an employee and what we're willing to offer you. So it's going that extra step. So it is well known, but not a lot of people have it, or at least not ones that I've seen. But yeah, people know about it.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. Well, you taught me something. Something I can keep my eye out for, something that transitioning service members can keep their eyes out for, an employee value proposition, or at the very least, like kind of what Pat had mentioned, when you're in the interview, you know, ask about whether or not they have a development program and what the promotion potential is in the organization, and then being transparent about what it is that you're looking for. So, yeah, very informative. So that's about it, folks. We're going to wrap it up. Thank you very much for listening. If you're watching, thank you very much for watching. If you're watching this on YouTube, help us out. I think this is our first video. So if you could like us, or give us thumbs up, that would just help us end up propagating this information a little bit easier, beating the algorithm so that we can get the information in the hands of transitioning service members. If you're listening to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please consider giving us a 5-star review. It helps us do the same. If you have any questions for us, you can send us an email at newmissionct@gmail.com. That's newmissioncharlietango, and we'll get back to you. Or you could follow us on Instagram at newmissionct and send us a DM. Good, bad, things that we didn't think of. Hey, we'll take all feedback so that we can improve upon what we're doing here and deliver quality content to help service members like myself transition successfully and with more confidence. So if you're preparing for your own transition, know that, well, I'm right there with you. So until next time, stay focused.